Welcome back to the fourth day of this mini course. I'm on Tensor Networks today, this morning. So what, let's quickly just recap what we did yesterday. So yesterday we had a discussion about matrix product states mostly, and the three things we were covering were how to gauge M matrix product states. So we're talking about gauge degrees of freedom. Then I was telling you how to truncate it. So there is there are ways to do wave function truncation on MPS. And we were discussing this in some detail. And then I was also giving you some arguments or explaining that an MPS has an area law built-in, so an area law of entanglement, such that the state can only represent MPS can only represent states with a finite amount of entanglement, the bounded amount of entanglement. Okay, and so what I want to discuss today is a little bit more technical, and this is why I'm switching the slides, because otherwise I think drawing all these diagrams will just take too long. So today I want to cover like four things, one in like, you know, in decreasing detail. So I'll start with real-time evolution. This I'll try to cover in the most detail. So we'll talk about a way to do real-time evolution of many-body systems, of one-dimensional many-body systems, specifically with one algorithm called the time-evolving block estimation that Giffre Vidal came up with. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about DMRG. So this is a way to find ground states of one-dimensional quantum systems. It's an algorithm on the manifold of MPS. I'll cover that in some detail, and then towards the end, I'll talk a little bit about PEPs and MERA, and we'll only talk about that in, you know, very superficially. So I will not have time to do these two topics any type of, give them the deserved amount of time and depth. But it is, I just wanted to like highlight a few things and tell you a little bit about it so that you have seen it at least once. Okay, so let's start with the first topic, which is real and imaginary time evolution. So why real and imaginary? So this is about time evolution, time evolution can be done in real and imaginary time. and I'll start off with real-time evolution, but towards the end I can tell you a little bit about how imaginary time can be used with the same algorithm as well to find, for example, ground states. Okay, so the setting is the following. We are given the setting is we're given some quantum state psi, right? So we're given some state psi. That's t equals 0. And this thing here could be some many-body state. You know, it's a many-body state in 1D. For example, the system of spins, right? You could have a lattice. And you could have like spins here, spin degrees of freedom. Could also be electrons, but the point is it's like a one-dimensional system. And we're given that state at time t equal to 0, and we have an efficient way of representing it. For example, in form of a product state, right? This could be something like up, down, down, up, if we're talking about spins. And then what we're also given is a Hamiltonian. So we have a Hamiltonian H here, that's this guy. And that Hamiltonian generates the time evolution of our quantum system. And we would like to essentially compute what's happening when I apply the propagator IHT to my state at t equal to 0, right? So computing this object here is like, that's our goal. The goal is to compute this. All right, so there are some restrictions that I want to enter here. And one is that the first is that the Hamiltonian that we're looking at here, so this H, is a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian. So this means it will be a sum over some HIs here, where I goes from 1 to n. So we'll have a finite system with n sites. And each of these HIs here is a Hamiltonian that will only connect nearest neighbor for now. So we can extend that. There are ways to relax that, but for now we'll consider that, yes?
So we're assuming the Hamiltonian is time independent?
Yes, the Hamiltonian is time independent. Okay. There are ways to extend that to time-dependent Hamiltonians. It's possible with minor modifications. All right, so we'll have a Hamiltonian that consists of these guys here, hi, and each of these hi's acts on sides I and I plus one, right? There is a graphical representation. That's this thing here. An example would be hi, could be something like, let's say you have a transverse fieldizing model, then it would be Sxi plus one plus b times, now it depends a little bit on how you set that up, but you could have something like Sc at I plus Sc at I plus one, and then you add a half here for some convenience, it doesn't really matter. But this could be an example of such a Hamiltonian. So we want to like evolve this thing forward in time. So what we'll do is we'll break this up into smaller pieces. So we have here, you know, our state at time t, which is given by this exponential, by this expression here, where you have an exponential of the Hamiltonian. And of course, the Hamiltonian commutes with itself. So what we'll do is we'll break this apart into smaller pieces, where you have something like a delta th, another delta th, and a bunch of them. All right, where each of these delta t is t divided by some number. Now I have to be careful because I was using n before. I don't know, let's call this just nt. Okay, so we're breaking this apart. Okay, still visible everything? So we'll break apart the propagator into smaller pieces that are all identical. And if it's a time-dependent Hamiltonian, then what we could do in this case is we could say something like these guys here, you know, would then all be different. So this would be an approximation. If you had a continuous evolution of the Hamiltonian, you could break that apart into discontinuous pieces. You know, so it's like a step function or something like that. And then you would just insert different ages here, depending on at which time you are. So this would be a way to, it's like, this is an approximate way, of course, to introduce the time dependence, but you could do it, and there is ways to refine it. So what we'll do is, what we want to do now, where the problem has essentially been reduced to the problem of applying this thing here, you know, to a quantum state, to some many-body state psi. So we're sort of like have reduced the problem now. The problem we're looking at now is just this first part here. We want to apply. So this guy. So what we want to do here? Let's put it here. So we want to do e to the minus I delta th acting on some psi. So this is the problem we're considering now. So we broke it down into smaller pieces, and this is like the main problem that we're dealing with now. So we want to find an approximation to that expression. And once we're able to do that, so once we found an approximation to this, to something like this, then we can just iteratively go from left to right, you know, and carry out the same sort of approximation over and over again, and that way we'll be able to like solve. Evolve this initial state psi at t equal to zero forward in time. And the way to do that is, we'll use some sort of, you have to do some approximations here. And the first approximation that we'll introduce is a so-called Suzuki-Trotter decomposition. So the problem is that this Hamiltonian H, you know, may have terms. I wrote this down. It's like we have it here. It's a Hamiltonian consisting of smaller parts, HIs, but these HI do not necessarily all commute with each other, right? So if you look at the Hamiltonian H, so this H here, H is broken, can be broken down into some sum over even sites, right? And then some sum over odd sites. Odd. We have hi and hi here. And what you know is that now we cannot really, so the problem is that if we've, yeah, let's say we want to compute the commutator for an even one, right? And for an odd one, then in general, if they are not overlapping, then the commutator is zero, right? So this could be zero. So if we, let's have this as j, zero if hi and hj, this is very, actually, I'll just say it because it's very hard to Right. So if HI and HT are acting completely independent of each other on different lattice sites, they will commute, otherwise they won't. So what we'll need to do to compute the exponential, we'll break this exponential down into two pieces, and we'll use the so-called Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula for that. So the basic idea is that if you have, first of all, if you are given an exponential of an of a sum of operators A and B, right? So that's essentially what we're considering. So A would be sort of the sum over even sites, and B would be the sum over odd sites. So what we want to compute is this expression, where A and B would be, so where this thing here would be A, and this thing here would be B. So we want to compute this thing. There's a T here. So if A and B are zero, we can just like break it apart. Very good. But in our case, it's not really happening. So the problem is that we have like operators there that don't commute. So in this case, we'll have to do a little bit more than that. And what we'll essentially do is we'll still use the same formula, and we'll forget about the rest, right? Because A and B, these Hamiltonians, these even and odd sites, do not fully commute with each other. We'll have that the exponential of A plus B is roughly equal to the exponential of A times the exponential of B. And then there will be some part missing here. And that is one approximation we're introducing. OK, so this is a second order error. Second order in delta t. So let's see. I was using delta here, but you can just have delta t. So here we have delta t squared. So it's second order in delta t. So if we make delta t very, very small, you know, then we can sort of say, well, it's a small error. We don't care so much about it. We'll just forget it for now. And there are ways of making that error even smaller. We can use, so this is like what people call, this is a first, the order here is second order in delta t. You can also make this better, right? There are improvements to this. Improvements are possible by going to higher order expansions of exponentials. We're not going to do that because it's mostly, for our purposes, it will be enough. All right, so this is some sort of application of the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula that you guys are probably familiar with. So how does this now look for our problem here? As I told you before, we have our Hamiltonian, it's the nearest neighbor, so we have even sites and we have odd sites. So HE and HO are acting on even sites and odd sites, or pairs of, you know, where I is even, where the first site is even, and pairs of the first site is odd. And of course, again, this is just a restatement. The problem, what we know is that the commutator of all operators within this sum are commuting with each other. So they're all commuting, but those two are not commuting, all of them. So now we can essentially use that to break it down into the following form. We have the exponential of this I delta th is, you know, a product of some even and some odd exponential. And that's the approximation that we're using. So this is, here we were using essentially the Baker-Campbell-Hausdorff formula. And everything else after that now, so once we've broken that apart, we can now do all the other exponentials exactly, because they're all commuting. So this thing here has only even operators in it, and they are all commuting, so we'll break the sum here. Here's a sum, and that sum now becomes a product, right? So this is a product over these operators HE over even sites, and this is a product over operators of on odd sites. And this is an exact expansion now. There is nothing, there is no error here. Okay, any questions so far? I mean, this is a very theoretical, but so now we'll go to the step two. What we have done is we have essentially broken down, let's recap quickly. So we have broken down this evolution into small steps. And each of these small steps here, you know, we've further broken that down into another set of small steps. So there is like small squared steps. And what we're going to do now is like apply all these approximations to our quantum state. Or this, you know, apply this to that evolution over a small time step. So again, here is our initial state. This is our psi at t equal to 0. Before, it could be, for example, a product state, the one that I've shown before, or it could just be a simple MPS with a small bond dimension d here, right? So let's say this has some small bond dimension d, small d. And what we're doing now is we are applying that single small time step that we wanted to do before, you know, over a small delta t to our initial state. And what we've seen, you know, I'm just like drawing out the formulas now that I've shown you before in diagrams. So here, so there's this breakup again into even and odd part. So this thing here is the even part. Oh, sorry, the odd part. This is the odd part. And this thing is the even part. And the full evolution is just given by the product, right? And this is a, this the product. So what I'm drawing here are gates, right? Each of these gates is the exponential of, let me actually, where was I using the wrong? So these should be small h's here, right? This is not capital H, this is small h. So here we have h, 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 h. Okay, so these are all, and I'm a little bit inconsistent with indices I here, but it doesn't matter because it's obvious from the drawing where they live, right? So we don't have to worry too much about indices at this point anymore. So that's essentially a diagrammatic representation of the states at, you know, evolved by a small time step delta t. So what do we have to do now? Is so that broke down from what we've seen is like the MPS structure is gone, right? This is no longer an MPS, okay? There have been gates applied all over the place. There's no, it doesn't really look like an MPS anymore. So we have to break this down again into a format. So if we want to repeat this procedure, we'll have to simplify that structure. Otherwise, we won't be able to proceed because we want to apply many more layers as we go along, right? There will be many more of those guys coming, right? One, two, three, four, five, hundreds maybe. So we need to recover that. And what we'll do is we'll do the truncation. This we'll apply a truncation, the same one that we discussed yesterday, okay? So that works in a very simple, you know, I'll just like briefly sketch that here. So we can represent this structure here, right? This whole thing is another, you know, we can, oh, actually, no, excuse me. We'll only look at the first part here. What we'll do is now we'll sequentially apply these gates here to the MPS, one after the other. And at every time we apply it, so we'll start with this one. We first apply this guy. And once we applied it, we lose the MPS form, but then we'll recover it. And then we'll move to the next one. Then we'll go here. So we start with this, and we move here, and we move here. Then we move here, then we do this, and so on and so forth. So we sort of cycle through these operators, one after the other. We apply them to the state. Every time we apply them, we lose the MPS form, and we recover it via a truncation. So that's what I'm showing you here, down here, so this thing here. So we start with the MPS, we apply the gate, and what we'll have to do now, we'll have to truncate. And what we'll do is we'll bring the state into an orthogonal form such that everything to the right, everything here, everything to the right of the place, everything that's coming to the right of the place where we applied the gate is right orthogonal, right? So this is what these triangles should, you know, show. This is what these triangles here mean. And once we've done that, we can now go ahead and take this guy here, so this thing, and we can apply an SVD to it, right? This is what this diagram here is showing you. So what happened here is that this thing, you know, became this thing. So we were essentially just taking, you know, this object, where we had it this way, and we were cutting it apart here. So we cut it apart here, OK? okay, via an SVD. So there's actually a bond, an MPS here, and you know, let's just assume there is also a bond dimension here. And the way it's done is the following. You know, we combine these legs into like a tensor, sorry, into a single leg, so this becomes a matrix. And then this we can just do an SVD of. And I'll draw the second leg here as well, just so that it's easier to understand. And then we'll just bend the legs. Sorry, we'll just bend the leg down again. And there we go. We broke it apart. Now what happened? This so far has everything been exact. But it turns out, if you do that, then the bond dimension that you, here you had a bond dimension D, now you have a new MPS, now you have a new bond dimension D, it turns out that that bond dimension just became bigger than it was before. And it became bigger by a factor of small d, right? Where small d is the dimension of the physical indices, right? This is the dimension of the physical indices, 2 if it's spin 1/2 degrees of freedom. So that became larger. So that's bad, because if you keep on doing that, you will get an exponential grow of bond dimension, which comes with an exponential increasing cost. So what we'll do is we'll truncate. That's what you always do if you run an MPS simulation, or very often. So you truncate, you throw away a certain number of singular values, right? So what we're doing here, we were throwing away some singular values. And of course, we're throwing away the small ones, not the big ones, because this means the error is smaller. We'll try to keep the error low. So we'll throw away the small singular values, and we keep track of what we threw away, right? So that's also important. Keep track of what was thrown away. Because that way, we can sort of have some information about how poor our simulation becomes as we keep on going, because we will keep throwing away stuff over and over again, and the result is that at some point this solution or this algorithm will just break down, or it will not break down technically, it will just mean that whatever you get out of it is no longer what you wanted to get out of it. Okay, so, and we repeat that for every step, for every gate, right? So hey, we have done this now for this first gate, so we go here, we did this for this guy. So we were applying the MPS, so the gate, we're breaking it down into new MPS, so now we can move to this guy. So we'll do the same here. We'll apply the gate, we'll break it into a new MPS. Then we go here, then we go here. Once we've done that, we've essentially contracted all the gates in the first layer. So now those gates here, they're all contracted into the MPS, and all these gates here, they're all in the MPS. And then we'll move to the second layer, the even layer, and do the same stuff there. So now we have evolved the state over a small time step. And then we can just repeat that over and over again for all the other operators that are coming along here, right? So we did this. Now we'll do it for this. And we'll do it for each one, the same thing. And that's it. That's the time evolving block decimation. Yes?
Is the order of contraction in this case, because every step you are throwing away stuff.
So the order of contraction, so yes, so the point is that that's, so the order of contraction here, it matters, right? Because we're doing this breakup, right, of the Tsutsuki. So it's easier to go first this, then this, then this, then this. They're all commuting with each other, right? So and it's an easy way of breaking down, you can apply it and get back an MPS. If you would go this and then this down here, right? Well, that's tricky. How are you going to do that? Because you can apply the first one, you can break it into new MPS, but then you have this thing here, right? But now you have an open leg here and an open leg here. So, you know, you could do it. It's not like you cannot do it, but it's a little bit more costly probably and a little bit more cumbersome. Okay. So then there's so the two sources of errors. One is the Trotter-Tsutsuki breakup. And I was showing you the first So I keep on confusing if one says first order or second order breakup. The point is that the error is second order. So it's delta t squared. So you're making an approximation, assuming that the operators are commuting. So you make an error. And that error is proportional to the square of the time step you're taking. So it's small, and you can make it smaller if you want. If you want to, in practice, for many applications, it's negligible. It doesn't matter so much, because there's other sources of errors which are overwhelming that type of error. So then you don't have to worry too much about it. If you're worried, you can go to higher order expansions. So you can do second, third, fourth order, like people have done very high orders. The cost becomes higher, of course, to do all the contraction. Because then instead of just having two layers, so here we had only, where was it? Here we had only two layers, right, per time step. If you go to higher and higher orders, then you get more, right? It's not just two, it may be three, four, five, something like this. And you can still apply the same procedure, it's just more costly to get to a certain time. And the benefit of going, well, it's not that easy to say, because the benefit of going to higher order also means you can go to larger time steps, and there's some sort of a trade-off. So you have to like judge, every case needs to be judged differently to see if it pays off or not. But the more severe error is the truncation error. So I was telling you have to truncate the singular values. That is a huge error. That is the major source of errors when you go along and do these type of evolutions. And the reason is that the entanglement, real-time evolution produces entanglement. And I just want to quickly show you. I'm not going to show you anything like specific. I will just draw it out for you. I'll sketch it for you what the main problem is. So people, for example, you could apply this to the case of doing a global quantum quench. In, for example, the Ising model. So that's an example, that's like an application that people have looked at, global quantum quenches of the Ising model. So what is a global quantum quench? I'll explain you in a bit. So we start off with the Ising model. So you're given a Hamiltonian, this is the one we just discussed. And you use some algorithm, I don't know, DMRG, or some other method. You could also use imaginary time evolution. I'll explain that in a bit. To get the ground state psi, right? That depends on some parameter j and beta, because here you had two parameters in it, right? J, which is an interaction between spins, and B is a magnetic field. Okay, so depending on those parameters, you get some ground state. So what you'll do now, so we have a ground state with some parameter j and beta. So what we'll do now is we'll quench j to some other value j prime, which is different from j. And then we'll get a Hamiltonian that depends, let me write it this way, so we have a Hamiltonian j prime and b prime, j and b, j prime and b. And now we'll use that to do a time evolution of our state here. So we'll do e to the minus I h j prime here and b times t over some time t, and apply that to our initial state psi that was obtained for j and b. Okay, so what's happened here is this, we call this state psi of t. So this was the ground state of hjb, right? Which means that if you do e to the minus I hjbt onto this and apply it to this psi of j and b, right? Well, nothing happens, right? You essentially, because it's an eigenstate, right? You will get e to the minus I some phase and the same state back, right? Jb. Nothing happens. But we were quenching the Hamiltonian here, which means this state here, this is no longer an eigenstate of our h. So it's different. It's different. So there is non-trivial evolution going on. And now if you would look at a MPS, right? So let's say this is our state this here should represent our psi of t, right? This thing here. What we'll do now, so we can look at two regions here. You know, again, we look at bipartite entanglements. That's this is region A. And here we'll have region B. And we'll look at a cut across this region. And what we're looking at now is how does the entanglement across this cut behave as we simulate the time, as we simulate the evolution of the state, right? So what you'll see is this is time. This is S of, let's say, rho A. This is the entanglement, you know, of the reduced, the entanglement of the left system, or, you know, you look at the reduced density matrix of the left system, compute the eigenvalues, and then you compute the entanglement entropy of that. And what you'll see is that there will be some initial value as zero, right? That was because it was a ground state, it had some non-trivial entanglement, it wasn't much, it was just a bit, we were happy. So now, what you'll see is that this will just grow linearly, right? And for the sake of the argument, we'll assume that this is just very, very large, you know, and there will be, it will just keep on growing. If this was infinite, an infinite system, it would just keep on growing and growing and growing.
This is without quenching? Anything?
This is the quench. So what we're looking at here is the time t. This is the entanglement entropy, right? If you want to say what we're looking at here is S of rho A, right? Where rho A is the trace over B of psi of t, psi of t.
Did you quench at the time equals zero?
Yes, at time equals zero, we quench. So at time equals zero, we sort of switch the Hamiltonian, and then we'll evolve it forward. So this grows linearly. So that's bad news, because you may remember that the entanglement entropy that an MPS can represent is bounded by log of d, the log of the bond dimension, right? So we know that S of, I don't know, like MPS, has always to be smaller than log d. So there is this an upper bound. What we're seeing now is that the entanglement grows linearly, right? We'll see that S of t is something like some constant times t, right? And that means that that from this it results that the MPS bond dimension needs to grow exponentially to be able to capture that, right? So d needs to grow exponentially in order to be able to keep up with that entanglement growth. And that's bad news, because that's just not possible. So there's a takeaway message here is that time evolution with MPS is not classically feasible.
Why is this linear? Is it something about information propagating?
Yes. It has to do with the fact that you are creating quasi-excitations. You quench the Hamiltonian, you create quasi-local excitations that can travel across the system and will start to spread entanglement. So they further and further region can sort of entangle with each other.
And that's just particular to that specific Hamiltonian?
So this is what, no, this is, I mean, so it's not always, so there, like, entanglement behavior over time can be very, like, can show very different types of behaviors. But for this, but this is a generic problem that the entanglement grows for global quenches linearly. And
so generically, time evolving block estimation doesn't work then? Is that?
It breaks down at some point. So for global quenches, very quickly. So what you'll see, in fact, is if you look at a finite system, then this will start at some point to level off, right? And that value here, you know, if you look here, this value, there's some rho star, that value depends on the size of the system, right, of rho A. So if you would so if you have a very small rho A, then it would just stop here. A little bit of larger rho A would be here. So it depends on the size of rho A. So, but I mean, but it's still infeasible. So local quenches are a little bit easier. If you have a local quench, then what you're doing is you're only, you take a ground state, for example, and make a small change to one particular place in the system. And in that case, the entanglement will grow weaker. It's usually, so it grows like logarithmically with time. And that means it's much easier to do it, but still it is, you know, there's not, you'll run into trouble at some point.
So if you had a Hamiltonian that you, say you knew how it evolved, so you wouldn't need time evolving block estimation, but you knew that it evolved through separable states with very low entropy,
mm-hmm.
And then you applied the algorithm, and then you were working with a Hamiltonian, there was a small deviation from that, would TBD still be a candidate convergent algorithm? or?
So you're saying that you know that your Hamiltonian does only connect states with low entanglement. So you have one evolution that goes through some sort of low entanglement region.
I'm working on a specific problem where, yeah, the reference ideal system shows low entanglement. So it's basically a state that propagates down a chain of spins because of some highly tuned parameters.
Mm-hmm.
But now my Hamiltonian's a perturbation of that. So I suspect, but I don't know without a proper simulation, which requires some efficient algorithm, I suspect it won't evolve into highly entangled state. So
yeah, so this is something I mean, in general, I would expect, so if it's a unitary evolution and you don't have any coupling to some sort of outside degrees of freedom that could help you disentangle, and if the system has, so if the Hamiltonian connects different parts of the system with each other, if there's not just the one body like interactions, you know, you could just have a sequence of one body gates, and then that would not introduce entanglement. But if you, I mean, I can see that it's possible maybe that if you choose very special type of gates that do not introduce any type of entanglement or only, then you could keep in a low, but in some sort of a low entanglement region. But I actually doubt that, because as soon as you, so you keep on applying, if one gate can introduce a little bit of entanglement, then you keep on applying that gate over and over again. I think I would expect that entanglement will be just created at some rate. Maybe the rate is lower than for some other problem, but I still would expect it to like be growing.
Sorry to derail the conversation.
No problem. Okay, so that's that part. Any questions? If not, then I'll wanna like move on to something else. Yes.
Yeah, so in this entanglement graph, I'm curious what kind of physical parameter determines the slope here.
That's a good question. People have looked at that.
Okay.
So I think it's related to the speed of propagation of particles in the system.
But probably it infers of some typical energy.
Sorry?
Infers of certain energy scale in a problem.
So something I don't actually know from the top of my head.
Okay.
But I think I remember that it has to do with there was like low energy excitations that can localize low energy excitations that can travel at certain speeds, and if they can travel very fast, then you will get a stronger increase, and if they only travel very slowly, then you get a weaker increase.
Okay.
So I think it's somehow related to. It is related to properties of the spectrum, but the details, I don't know. I would have to look that up myself.
Thanks.
Question?
Yes?
This computation, this algorithm, is it in practice, is it parallelizable or is it?
It is, yes. So there are ways of making it parallelizable. The way the one I explained to you today and right now is not. So that one goes through sequentially, but there are other types of gauges you can use so that you can apply these gates in parallel. That's possible. Okay. All right, so let's switch. So I have got a bunch of slides I'm going to skip here because I don't have a lot of time. So the next thing I want to discuss today is an algorithm called density matrix renormalization group, which is a method to compute. One additional thing I wanted to mention, I forgot that, and with regards to, I was promising you to talk about imaginary time evolution as well, right? So we were talking here about real time evolution. You can also do imaginary time evolution, right? So I'll actually just let me add a comment here. You can do ground states. So this method can be used to do ground states, to compute approximations to ground states from imaginary time evolution. Okay. So in this case, things look much different, right? There is no entanglement growth, and it's a very, very different type of scenario. Imaginary time evolution means that instead of doing evolution with t, you go to it, right? And people usually call this tau. Okay, so then What you do is you apply e to the minus tau h to some initial state psi at t, or sorry, at tau equal to zero, and just keep on doing that, right? And you can, the same, really, like almost literally, the same algorithm you can apply in the same way to this type of problem. So you break up the Hamiltonian in the same way, you apply the gates in the same way. The only difference is that because this is not unitary anymore, so the evolution is no more unitary, and this means that the norm is not preserved. So the state norm will shrink as you go, so you'll have to keep on renormalizing. But that's one of the, you know, that's the main difference. Otherwise, it works pretty much the same. And to get, and again, to get very accurate ground state approximations, you may need to like make the time step smaller and smaller. So you can start off with large steps and then make them smaller and smaller and smaller. And the accuracy will depend on the size of the time step.
Do you only get the ground state through that method?
Typically, yes. So it will just if you have a manifold, if you have a degeneracy, then you'll get some sort of superposition in that ground state manifold. But yes, it will just, because you will always have, it will be, you will only ever be able to get an excited state if you can make sure that you project out all overlap with the ground state from the first, from that trial state. But then you need to truncate, and then it'll sort of come, it will come back. So maybe there is a way of doing it. I don't know. So I don't think I have never seen anything like that. Okay, so now DMRG. So DMRG is a. So I was telling you about real-time evolution, and you can also use that to do ground states, to compute ground states. There is one very famous method that is in fact actually like the origin of all this like tensor network research, which is called the density matrix renormalization group. So this is an algorithm that has been invented by Steve White in 1992. And it has, when he invented it, there has been no connection to matrix product states, like tensor networks was not a research direction, and nothing of that has existed. People were aware of MPSs at that point, but it was unconnected with DMRG. That method, so Steve has developed this method to compute ground states of one-dimensional quantum systems.
And you said that back then it was also a really computational method, not some sort of...
It was always a computational method. So Steve White looked at, was interested in solving ground states for spin, for one-dimensional spin chains. And he was a student of Kenneth Wilson. So Kenneth Wilson invented the numerical renormalization group. And DMRG is heavily inspired by things that are going on in the numerical renormalization group. But it's a different algorithm. There are similarities, but there are also differences. And he applied this first to solve ground states for spin systems, one-dimensional spin systems. And it was later on, this was a groundbreaking result. It's like cited like almost 8,000 times by now, this paper. And it was only later realized that there's some connection between DMRG, this algorithm that I'm going to explain to you, and matrix product states. But today, there is like an old formulation of the algorithm that goes back to what Steve White has done and the way he views it. And then following that research, this sort of spawned into this field of tensor networks. And people realized that there are ways to rephrase this whole optimization algorithm in terms of matrix product states, and that's what I'm going to like quickly tell you, or I'm going to explain you DMRG from the viewpoint of matrix product states, and not from, it's just using a separate language. It's the same, the results remain identical, it's just a separate language. Okay, so in the modern formulation, that's what I call the modern formulation of DMRG. And there's many reviews, and many people have actually contributed to that. Like Tomotoshi Nishino is one that was like, I think, very, one of the early people who have like pushed the development or the understanding of DMRG in terms of, other matrix product state wave functions, for example. Giffre Vidal has worked on that, Frank Verstraete, Ignacio Sirac. There is a long list of people who have contributed to this like modern formulation of DMRG. So the goal for this, the motivation is that we want to find the approximation to the ground state of a one-dimensional Hamiltonian, a one-dimensional spin system that is local. Again, for example, our favorite friend, the Ising model. Ising model in 1D, you know, it's just a... And the method that DMRG uses is a variational ansatz. So it optimizes an MPS, essentially. So you make an ansatz for a wave function, in this case, a matrix product states, and you optimize that state to minimize the energy. It's like an application of the variational principle. Very simple. It's like really the variational principle that you all, I guess, I think you learn in quantum mechanics 1, right? You take an ansatz for a wave function. So that's your wave function psi. So psi is an MPS. So yeah, we have it here. So you take your MPS wave function psi, and then what you want to do, you compute this expectation value, psi h psi, and you want to minimize that over all possible ansatzes, you know, that over all possible states that are within this ansatz class. And then you also have to normalize this, because if your wave function, you know, you want to make sure this is just the rules of quantum mechanics. Well, no wave functions have to be normalized. So what you want to minimize is this expression here. That's your cost function. And DMRG is a way to do that. You can very easily like show this, or there is like a very nice diagrammatic representation of that. That's what you'll see here in this box that I'm drawing here. Okay, so this is a diagrammatic representation. So there are some things in there that you already know. So this here is your state psi. That's an MPS. Okay, this is the ket. And this thing in the middle that I haven't actually explained you yet what that is the Hamiltonian. Okay, so and this is a representation of a Hamiltonian in, for example, the Ising model in terms of a tensor network. I haven't told you anything about that yet. I'm not going to tell you a lot about it. I just want to quickly demonstrate make this a little bit more, just give you a few words so that you will feel more comfortable with it, essentially. So this thing is what people call a matrix product operator here in the middle. So it is a representation of a Hamiltonian, H, in terms of a tensor network. So each of these guys here is a tensor, okay? If I would write this out in a formula, it would roughly look like this. So it would actually exactly look like this. Let me use different letters here. M, alpha 0, alpha 1, I1, I1 prime. So this is a sum that runs over degrees of freedom, I. And let's assume each of these i's here, right? Each of these i's is a spin 1/2 degree of freedom for now. So this is very similar to a matrix product state, actually. Right? So then is and then because this now is an operator. It looks like that, okay? So this is just what I'm doing here is I'm just expanding an operator in a basis. That's all, right? Where you have this here is the basis. So you have bras and kets, right? Ij, I guess you're all familiar with that. So if you want to write an operator in such some basis, you can always write it in terms of the matrix elements. That's what I'm doing here. And the matrix elements are simply, in this case, there is some, they take on this very special form in terms of a matrix product operator. Okay, where each of these M's here is this. It's just a tensor with four legs. Where the vertical legs, usually called ancillaries, they have the same role that an MPS bond dimension has. These are the horizontal, and the vertical legs are the physical indices. For example, IK could be 0 or 1, you know, if we're talking about spin systems for spin 1/2. The important point is that any local operators can be cast into MPO format exactly, okay? With a low bond dimension, with low bond dimension. For example, the Ising model has, I think the Hamiltonian has a bond dimension of 4. Or 3, actually, I'm not sure. I think it's 4. Okay, so this means that it is a very light tensor network. And there is, you can do it exactly. So there are rules, and you can learn how to do it. I was actually originally planning how to do it. It's a beautiful topic, but I'm not going to explain it because it will just take too much time. But I'm happy to chat about that, you know, offline. So you can come to my office, you know, anytime. Okay, so where are the parameters of this state? The parameters are in here, in these MPSs, right? All these MPSs, they all have the parameters. So there are, in total, so each tensor has how many? This is d, 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 d squared by d parameters. And what we're doing is we're trying to optimize those parameters to lower the energy, right? We want to find those parameters that minimize the energy. And DMRG is a specific algorithm of how to do that. And I'm just going to quickly walk you through very hand-wavingly how this works. And the algorithm, what I'm going to show you is not the real algorithm. It is, you know, an approximation to the real algorithm. If you really want to do it, you'll have to go back and look into the details, because it is, you know, there is like many details that need to be considered. But the basic idea, I will give you enough so that you can go and read a paper and, you know, understand roughly what is going on. So what we'll do is we want to optimize the state, and DMRG does this iteratively, right? So we'll start at one side, the one I highlighted red here. What we're going to do is we will optimize this guy, and we'll keep these ones fixed, okay? We'll not change them. We'll keep them fixed. And we'll do some sort, there is some way of doing that. There are, you know, ways of optimizing. You could, in principle, just throw a black box optimizer at it if you feel, you know, that's going to do the job. It's probably not going to do it, but you could. It would just be a poor approximation, but you would still get something out of it. So that's what we'll do. We'll optimize that side. And once we found it, you know, red means now we found the best tensor we can put there so as to lower the energy by a little bit. Once we've done that, we move to the next side, right? So now we go to this side. Now, I'll actually need to do it this way. Let me just remove this. So what we'll do now, these ones are fixed, and this one is fixed, okay? And we'll optimize this guy. And we'll do that until it converges. Now we have found like something that is lower in energy. And now we keep on going again. Same thing, fixed, fixed, and this one is optimized. Okay, and then we just keep on doing that until we arrive at the right side. This was what people call a right sweep. You go once through the system. Once you've optimized every site, you finished one sweep, or a right sweep. And then you just go and do the same thing starting from the right-hand side. Right now it's like, again, so now I'm changing here colors to green so that you know roughly that, you know, that this now is being optimized. This is optimized and this is kept fixed. And now this is fixed, and these are fixed. And this one is optimized, and you know, and so on. You get the idea. This is what people call a left sweep. So this is roughly how DMRG works. And then you need to go back and forth all the time, and at some point, hopefully, it will converge. Okay, so there is. I'm going to skip this. This is like some details about how you compute all the gradient. So you can do some sort of gradient type optimization. I'm not going to talk about that, but I can, you know, I'm happy to chat about that after the lecture. So here I just want to give you some sort of a quick highlight, you know. So again, DMRG is one of the most powerful algorithms that in people in, that that exists in quantum many-body physics. So it's a very, very extremely widely used algorithm, has numerous applications, and DMRG itself already has, and then there exist like variants of it, many different types of variants. It has inspired other algorithms like PEPS or MERA, or you know, a lot of different types of methods originate like from this idea. So yeah, it is a groundbreaking idea. And here, you know, just to give you three applications. So people originally looked at ground states of one-dimensional quantum systems. After that, this really ignited the field of tensor network research. So this is like all came out of this initial publication. You can use it to compute low-lying excited states. DMRG forms the basis for other types of algorithms, like time evolution is one thing I've already discussed. This is the TVD, but then there is like other variants that are closer in spirit to DMRG that can also do time evolution. More recently, people have found a so-called time-dependent variational principle that is also very closely connected to DMRG in some sense, and this can be used to do both time evolution or to or finding ground states. Yeah, so it's used, or some of these technologies are used when you do like contractions of more complicated networks, for example, PEPS. You know, supervised learning and generative modeling, that's something that has appeared over the past, you know, 5-6 years. It's a thing that people are now using and are like looking into with tensor networks. And also there, like these are optimization algorithms are popping up, not exactly DMRG, but something that is, you know, very much inspired by it. Yeah, and people can also, I was talking about one-dimensional quantum systems here, but you can also apply this to two-dimensional systems, right? So despite the fact that it has been tailored or originally developed for that, people, and like Steve White, for example, has spearheaded that, is looking at two-dimensional systems, two-dimensional Hubbard models, very complicated systems. But that's something, we'll have to go a little bit longer again, if that's okay. Like 10 minutes more. Are people okay with that? Okay. I would like to cover a little bit more. But just to give you a heads up, if you go to 2D, there are some fundamental limitations here. So one approach that people do to apply this to two-dimensional systems is, you know, what I'm drawing here is a lattice, right? So not something to eat, but a lattice of quantum systems. So, you know, on each degree of freedom, on each vertex here, you could have, again, spins. I'm not drawing everything because it's, like, too burdensome. And to be able to do, like, and the lattices here, you know, you would have, like, Hamiltonians or Hamiltonian terms connecting, for example, those two, and then there could be something connecting those two. And then those two. On these links, you have sort of connections between interaction terms. So to be able to do that with DMRG, you know, one simple idea is you go and you're trying to, you will just assume that you force this 1D topology on this whole system, right? You go through like this as an example. And you can do that. That's what people call the snaking approach. Now you have a cover, you have covered a 2D system with a 1D line, and you can apply DMRG and so on and so forth. But there are some problems that we'll discuss, you know, I'm going to discuss now. The main problem is that the Hamiltonian is long range, right? Because there are now systems going like this, couplings going like this, and this means, you know, this is a transformation that makes the system, the Hamiltonian, no more local, and that's kind of problematic. People, and as a last thing I want to mention, just quantum chemistry. Quantum chemistry is also an application of DMRG. It's actually very successfully used there.
Can you just say a little bit more about those applications? Do they, in my mind, that's like three-dimensional, or is it two-dimensional, or how does that?
You mean in chemistry?
Yeah.
So in chemistry, there is no dimension anymore. So it is in principle three-dimensional because it is a little bit more involved. There is like two, broadly speaking, two directions that people are exploring. One, Steve White is doing one thing, and then there is another community, Garnet Chan, Urs Legesa, and Marcus Ryan. So Ms. Garnet Chan.
Yes.
Garnet Chan is he's like doing that. Another one, another person in the field is Urs Legesa, or Ursh Legesa. So those two have sort of, they are sort of the main drivers of this field. I think they have been looking at quantum chemistry application, DMRG applications in quantum chemistry for since 2000, I think, or something like that. So a long time ago.
How does DMRG know that it found the ground state as opposed to some local minimum?
So it doesn't. So there's always a danger that you'll be stuck there, but there are ways to check the state. So you can compute, for example, the variance of the state to see if, so if it's more costly, the variance of the Hamiltonian. If you compute the variance of the Hamiltonian, if that goes to zero, you'll know you're in an eigenstate. Maybe, I mean, if you're very unlucky, you're in an excited eigenstate. But I mean, in general, I don't think there is a guarantee. But I mean, in principle, what you'll do, yeah, I mean, you have to use your judgment.
What if there's some theorem that you're continuously connected to the lowest state, but no way?
I don't think so. So I think there is one paper where I am aware of a paper where people claim that they, you know, this type of algorithm, a variant of that, you can give rigorous, you can rigorously show that this algorithm will converge to the ground state. It's like a computer science type of argument. But I, at the end of the day, I don't know like what this means in practice, right? If this means you have to go infinitely slow, and I don't actually know the details of the algorithm or anything. So of that paper. So I don't know. But it can happen. In practice, it happens. You get stuck, and then you have to like think about how to fix it. Yes.
When you say H is long range, like how? What do you mean by long versus like short?
So it means that long means that usually, like if you, this Hamiltonian in a regular basis is, you know, if you look at this, like so let's say you have a nearest neighbor Hamiltonian where H is a sum over ij, and you have something like, let's just look at this Heisenberg model, Si is j. Okay, so then you have terms that are connecting, let me erase a few things here. You will have terms that will connect, you know, those two lattice sites. And then maybe those two. So each, you know, there's like on each link, there is an interaction term where one S is living here. There's an S here. And then there is an S here, for example, right? And in this 2D geometry, then it is local, right? Because you're at this point, and there's only four points close by where it connects to. So yes, that's local if you're in 2D. But if you go to a 1D connection, like if you do this thing again where you like, you know, go, sorry, now that's, let me actually draw it this way. So you go like this. So now what happened is that this site here, right? So let me actually draw this as a lattice, right? So now we'll draw this out. There's a lattice, okay? And it's 1D, okay?
But like, how do you define local versus long?
So it means that it's no longer nearest neighbor.
Okay.
Right? And the distance, so if those two guys here, one could live here, and the other one could live here, right? Because this lattice site might map to this one, and this lattice site might map to this one. And the distance in between this is essentially given by, that's actually wrong. I meant, like, let's consider those two, right? So because I was actually drawing it the wrong way, sorry about that. So if you look at one operator here and one operator here, then you'll see that this guy gets mapped maybe to this side and this to this side, and the distance in between here is given by, ooh, this long way, you have to go, I have to go down, I have to go up again, right? And if you stretch this thing out, if you make it wider and wider, then this distance will grow larger and larger, right? And it will become arbitrarily long range depending on how large you make this system. Okay, so let's see if we can like give you like, can like, I think I'll manage to scare you off of PEPS in like 5 minutes. Yeah.
Sorry, one more question. Can you comment on like the the relative performance of the DMRG method to another ground state variation calculation?
It's actually a very good question, yes. Thanks for bringing that up. Yes, so the DMRG scaling is, I should have said that. So DMRG scales the computational scaling is D cubed times N, something like that. So it's linear in the size of the system and cubed in the bond dimension. That is roughly how TBD, so TBD has the same scaling. It also works in that way. So that is typically what you'll see. D cubed is one of the best scaling tensor network algorithms. Go with D cubed. Yes?
And just a general question, when you run an algorithm like this, people tune the bond dimension, or is that
yes.
something that the algorithm does?
It is possible to do that. So you can, so in practice, that's what you'll do. In practice, you use a variant of the algorithm that allows you to modify the bond dimension as you go along. So you can start with a small bond dimension, in which case it is cheaper to do the optimization, and the state is of course poor, but you do, what you do is typically you will increase the bond dimension. So you'll start, if this is the iteration number, and this is the bond dimension, you'll start at some small value, 10, I don't know. And then you may go, you know, so depending on how you choose to do it, but there are algorithms where the bond dimension will just, you know, start growing, and then at some point you'll reach, you know, the maximum bond dimension you can afford, and then you'll just keep it there, and then you just keep on going with the algorithm at that bond dimension. But is so the point is, in most hard applications, the majority of the time is spent here in this like regime where you already have exhausted the bond dimension, but you'll still, this one can still save you some time, right? And it might help you to sort of get to a better state, because you know you have there are like advantages to using it, to doing it that way. Okay, so just quickly, so I just want to go through one thing. So I just want to like explain you what PEPs are. So like we were talking about one-dimensional quantum systems, MPS, and so on and so forth. So people were thinking, and I was telling you, well, we can do 2D quantum systems with the snaking approach, right? I'm just like drawing it again here. Beautiful. We'll just do this. People were like, all right. I think at some point in the past, people thought, well, we'll figure it out. We'll just do that. And that's it. But it turns out it's not that easy. And the problem is, if you do that snaking approach, let's say we want to approximate a ground state, what we know is that, let's say we consider this case, we have a system L by L, we cut it here in half. We know this is an area that the system may have grabbed ground state. What we know is there's an area law, right? So this means that the entanglement of that state, S of rho, let's say this is A and this is B. So then we know that S of rho A, this is a two-dimensional system scaled somehow like the linear size of the system. So we know that MPS can only represent entanglement that is an upper bound by D, okay? So the problem is that because of this scaling, right, we know that log, you know, you just take the exponential here, right? You say D has to grow like the exponential of the entanglement in A, right? So this is S A. So you just, you know, place it in here, you'll get the bond dimension has to grow exponentially, right, to be able to capture that. So the bond dimension has to grow exponentially in the linear size of the system if you want to do L by L systems. And that's just not possible. It's like infeasible. So people have thought about ways of figuring, you know, circumventing this type of problem. One very famous and widely used approach is PEPs. So PEPs means projected entangled pair states. And it is a different type of representing a many body wave function in terms of an in terms of a tensor network. And that's what I'm drawing here, right? So you represent your many body wave function again as a tensor network, but in this case, a 2D structure. So now you have, instead of having just a tensor with three legs in a 1D array, now you have a tensor with five legs. So this is this guy. So there's a physical leg with a wiggly line, and then there's like four ancillaries. You know, this is just like writing it out in a formula, and then you arrange them into some 2D structure. Okay, so you have like physical legs down here. So yeah, I already wrote it. So you have the physical indices down here, and you have the ancillaries here. These are called ancillary indices or ancillary legs. And you can have infinite or finite systems. You can have translational invariant systems, in which case they are all the same. You know, these guys here, all identical. And one important property that I just want to mention here quickly is that PEPs obey an area law. Okay, so you can show that if you look at that, again, the same argument as we did with MPS. We look at a PEPs here, okay? So this is a PEPs, and this red thing here is a region, region A. So here we have region A. And what we're going to do, you can compute the reduced density matrix of region A simply by taking, you know, this psi here. So this is psi. And then you compute rho is psi psi. Okay, so you take, is that somehow clear? So you, there's like two layers here. There's the top layer and a bottom layer, okay, where the top layer is psi and the bottom layer is this psi. So you take the top and the bottom layer of the state, and then you start doing the trace, which means you have now to contract physical indices and with each other, okay? And if you do this from an infinite perspective, what you'll end up with is a tensor network that looks exactly like that, okay? So there's a bunch of legs that have been here. So those guys have been, you know, there's like, they come from tracing out essentially the environment. Okay, so this is what happens if you trace out the environment. So diagrammatically, you can represent the reduced density matrix of region A as such a diagram. Okay, and now what I'm doing here, I'm just moving around legs, okay, and just like rearrange the diagram a little bit. So I take these guys, I map them to here. So this is this, this is this, this one is this, and this one is this. And then the same at the bottom, right? This one goes here. And so on and so forth. And all those legs that have an x here, I put them in here. Okay? So I'm just rewriting the density matrix a little bit. And what you'll see is if you count the number of legs here, how many do we have? So this is a reduced density matrix, okay? So that is like consists of some matrix A and its Hermitian conjugate A dagger. Okay, so there's a number of legs in between. Let's count. There are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, and if you, you know, do this more general, you'll see there are 4L of those ancillary legs in between, where L is the size of that region. Okay, where L is the size of this region. So we'll see there's 4L legs. So what this means is that what you're looking at here is a matrix that has a that from that diagram, you can deduce an upper bound for the rank of the matrix, okay? Because there's 4L legs, each leg has a bond dimension of D. So this means that the rank of this matrix is bounded by D to the 4L, because there's 4L legs, okay? Each leg has a dimension of D, so it's D by 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 D, by D, by D, by D, by D yeah, up to 4L. So D to the 4L is the rank, the maximum rank of that matrix. So now we know that this is a density matrix. If all of these eigenvalues of the density matrix were what? What do they have to, when is the entropy maximum? Exactly, if it's flat. So if the eigenvalues are all, it's a flat distribution, so then they're all equal. And it turns out, you know, you just like do the same calculation again, you will see that the entanglement entropy of this region scales linearly in L, okay, as a boundary. That's a boundary law. So PEPs have entanglement, have area law. And PEP state has area law entanglement built into it, in 2D. Great, you will think, fantastic. So let's actually, and there's like examples of PEPs that I'm not going to cover. So this is great. Hooray, you will see, we've solved it. But, and you know, we're one step closer, but in fact, what it turns out, so what you can, there is like, it. So this is, an, this class efficiently captures the area law, but there is one problem, which is you cannot contract it exactly, So this is like the main drawback or the main hurdle that that PEPs have is that there's no way of exactly contracting it. So we knew from MPS, MPS we can contract exactly. There's no approximation we'll have to do to be able to contract things with an MPS. We just do it, right? The MPS itself may be an approximation, but the contraction can be done exactly. Now with PEPs, the PEPs is an approximation, and the contraction has to be done approximately, right? There is like another source of approximation that comes in. So this is the main problem, or not problem, but that's what the main thing that people went in this, in like a lot of research goes into understanding how to best contract the PEPs, so such that, you know, the results that we get have the highest accuracy. And as an example is just, for example, the computation of a norm of a state of this PEPs, right? What people do is, again, diagrammatically, you have a top layer, psi, you have a bottom layer, psi, and you have a bottom layer, psi. And you have to contract those two together. You'll end up with some, what people call a double layer PEPs. You have to contract this thing. There is just no way how you can exactly, you cannot contract this thing exactly. So people have come up with various, so this is called a double layer PEPs, with various ways of computing observables. So computing the norm means contracting this infinite network, and there's approximate ways of doing that. I'm not going to tell you. There's many, many. Like, and a famous one is called the corner transfer matrix method, but I don't want to cover that. And the last network I just want to, like, I will be very quick. I want to quickly discuss is, do you have questions? I was very, very fast on PEPs. So the last thing I just want to show you is a mirror. Yes?
But is that due to the fact that you can't do it exactly because you can't do something like the NCON?
The cost grows exponentially. So there's this network. And if you think of this as being an infinitely large network, or let's say a very large network of 100 by 100 tensors, a 2D network, this thing is like 100 by 100. So then if you want to contract this, you will find out that no matter how you do it, the cost will grow exponentially. It will just become more, and so there will be more and more legs. You know, you'll have like larger and larger objects in the course of contracting this thing that have more and more legs sticking out. And at some point, you know, you'll be like, oh, there's like too many legs. I cannot store it anymore. So the exact contraction is too costly. The cost just grows way too much. So you cannot do it. So you have to do something else, which is approximate contraction. So there is ways of doing the contraction in such a way that you do a little bit of the contraction, and then you throw something out. And you try to throw just so much out that the cost doesn't grow, right? So you end up with something that has a constant cost as you keep on doing that. All right, and then one last very famous tensor network is the MERA. So the MERA, I feel like since I'm at PI, I have to mention MERA at least once. So MERA is another ansatz wave function for many body systems. And that takes on a very special form. That's what I'm showing you here. It has some sort of a tree-like structure. Okay. Again, these are all these blocks here that you see are tensors. In this case, they're very special tensors. They're unitaries and isometries. As we discussed, they have this type of property. So the squares are unitary matrices, which means if you take one and, you know, if you do this type of contraction, it will become one. And this is a unitary. If you do this type of contraction, it will actually become a one. I don't know why there's two legs, but anyway. So this network has how many parameters? So there is like a scale, right? So let's actually first start. You start with some number of layers down here, okay? Then there is a set of disentanglers. That's how you call these unitaries with four, these blocks. And then there is another set of triangles. These are the isometries that reduce map 2 to 1. They map 2 degrees of freedom to 1 degree of freedom. So they're like, MERA is organized in layers usually. So that's what people call, there's one layer here, then there's one layer here, and then there's one layer here, and it keeps on going, right? So there is, in principle, because every time for this type of MERA, you go up one layer, you reduce the number of bonds in that layer by a factor of 2. There are, and you originally had n, so it means that there are now log 2 of n such layers, right? You keep on going. So if you have 100, then log 2 of 100 is, I don't know what it is, but so many layers you'll have as you go up. And a very beautiful thing, first of all, how many parameters does it have? It has n. It has only n, like the number of parameters is proportional to n, right? Because you have like logarithmically, you're changing, you have an exponentially decreasing number of parameters, layers as you go up, legs or yeah, tensors as you go up. So there's like 2n parameters in this case. So it's linear. The system, this is efficient to represent linear number of parameters. So great, nothing bad happened here. And one interesting thing about MERA, this MERA network that I want to mention here, is it is again an example of a network that can be contracted exactly without approximations because of this very special structure that it has. Okay, so you can exactly contract it. And because of that, people have used this network as an ansatz wave function to compute ground states of many body systems. I'm not going through the exact details of how to contract observables and so on and so forth. The only thing I want to mention here is this, which is what the entanglement entropy scaling in MERA. So similar to the argument we had before, we want to understand if you look at a chain of a very long chain of spins, we have some region B, that's this, we have some region A in the middle. So this is my state psi represented as a MERA. So what I want to again compute is the trace over the region B of the state psi psi, okay? So it's a little bit more involved to arrive to do this, but I don't want to walk you through that. But what you'll end up with is an expression that looks like that, okay? You'll see this is the reduced density matrix. If you would do that, you can use multiple use of these two properties here. You'll just repeatedly use the fact that they will cancel, so that these guys, cancel out to identities. And you can use this fact to reduce the network into this form, something like that. And again, same argument as before, you'll see, here's my region A and a MERA. There is a number of bonds here. Here is one, here, 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 and then here. So we'll just massage that a little bit. So this is formally is equivalent to this, right? Where I just like took this large thing here and just like squished it into this like square. And then I'll just remove the square, right? I remove the square and make this. This is what this means. This triangle now becomes like a semicircle. I remove the square. And again, we count the legs that we were cutting here, right? So now we have like legs here. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 legs in this case. So again, we can make the same argument. We'll see, the rank of that matrix is D. So there is like a finite rank, right? Because each one of these legs gives me one factor of D. So the rank is D to the power of number of legs. And what you'll see is the number of legs in here is the number of legs in here that you were cutting here, right? This. You have to count. These were 6. And in more general cases, in a more general argument, you will see that the number of legs you had to cut is the logarithm of the size of L, right? And from that, it turns out, if you now go and compute the entanglement entropy, S of this row A, you will see it will grow like something like log L, okay? And this means that in 1D, for example, so MPS had the constant entanglement, right? It could not represent something like that. MERA can represent that. And if we remember back to our second lecture, I was telling you that critical quantum systems, for example, in 1D, have exactly that property, right? Critical systems in 1D have the property that their entanglement entropy of finite regions L grows like log L. So, and with that, I want to conclude. So, the argument, so the conclusion is that MERA is able to capture the entanglement properties of critical quantum systems, and that has from that follow a lot of very profound implications that I'm not going to cover, but I'm happy to chat about that after. All right, thanks so much. Sorry for taking so long, but I think I'm mostly through with what I want to cover. Okay.